Welcome to the Omfit Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Omfit DMI Podcast alongside the AWS Institute. My name is Bhavin Patel, Head of FinTech Research at Omfif, and today we talk to Sarai Shay, Director General at the National Bank of Cambodia, and Agne Makoskaite, APAC Head of Public Policy for Regulated Industries from Amazon Web Services. In today's discussion, we hope to cover financial inclusion and the role that technology plays. We will focus on how technology can overcome some of the challenges between certain excluded demographics as well as in creating financial and economic opportunities that may have otherwise been foregone. We hope to also include some examples and case studies of where technological solutions have worked in Asia and also highlight the role that cloud as a foundational technology could play in supporting financial inclusion. So thank you, Sarai and Agne, for joining me today. Sarai, I want to start with you. Today's advances in technology are once-in-a-generation opportunity for banking. As the IMF suggests, this includes the chance for inclusive banks to extend financial inclusion on an epic scale. It's a challenging environment for inclusive banks, but technologies like cloud and others are making huge differences. Can you share some thoughts as to how innovative technologies, cloud-based or otherwise, are changing the face of financial services across Southeast Asia?
Thank you, Bhavin, and thank you all for having me. I think generally it is agreed that technology, fintech in particular, will be a big changer for access to finance. Technology like cloud, and you mentioned about it, theoretically it makes adoption of new technology easier. Basically, if banks, financial institutions want to bring in digitization into their services, being able to use cloud service make it more affordable in terms of adoptions. So they don't have to spend extra on, their data center or recovery center, etc. So in a way, it's kind of like a phone, but what you need is the applications on the top of it, right? So it's to be able to have cloud, it's already, something that it's like having a phone, but you need to download the applications. And so you need all these innovative services in the payment space, in the insurance space, in a lot of services. An example of how I think digitization can help would be on know your customer. And I'm not referring to digital ID. A lot of the time when people don't have access to financial services is because, particularly loan, for instance, it's because the banks don't know who the customer are. So there's an asymmetry of information between the service provider and the users. And so when you're able to digitize, particularly starting in the payment space, because if you look at financial services, you have loans, you have credit, you have insurance, and you have payment, right? And for loans, you need to need a loan, and not everyone can afford that. Not everyone need a loan. For saving, you need to have money to save. And for insurance, it's quite a complex product. You have to understand, the policies, etc. But payment, everyone is doing it. And so I think the first entry to financial services would be payment. And if you can bring someone into the digital payment space, and what you can create is a digital footprint that would allow the service provider to better know you. So if you spend on a certain product at a certain amount within a certain period, it would enable financial institution to better understand you as a customer and therefore design a financial services that would suit your need. And so this is where I think digitization can help promote access to finance. And of course, there's many other examples, but I'll stop here.
Thank you, Sarai. Agne, I want to turn to you. How is technology helping here overcome some of these challenges that Sarai just mentioned? Can you give some examples of some of these success stories?
Thank you, Bhavin, and thanks a lot for having me. And nice to be speaking with you, Sarai, here today. So yes, when we talk about financial inclusion, definitely we're very supportive of cloud being used as a facilitator to that financial inclusion. The way we define cloud is it is on-demand delivery of compute power, storage, applications, and other IT resources through the internet with pay-as-you-go pricing. And really, cloud computing is helping to facilitate the digital shift of incumbent financial institutions, as well as market entry of new challenger fintechs. Cloud computing enables scalability at a lower cost and facilitates the provision of affordable financial services to significant populations of underbanked or unbanked. And at AWS, we're working with a variety of fintechs across the Asia-Pacific region to support them with their IT infrastructure requirements. The fintechs we work with offer really innovative services, payments, lending, insurance, and other services to consumers or also small and medium enterprises. So a few examples I wanted to share today. One would be Warung Pintar company in Indonesia, which basically translates into the name Warung Pintar translates into smart kiosks. So it is a fintech startup in Indonesia that uses technology to support services to traditional micro businesses. It allows them to sell food and daily essentials in accessible locations. Now, in addition to providing the kiosks, Warung Pintar uses cloud technology to manage point of sale transactions and analyze supply chain performance. On AWS Cloud, this backend infrastructure allows micro enterprises to record sales, analyze their data, monitor their business performance. Another example I wanted to mention is the Indian payments fintech EasyPay, which allows its 6 million customers to settle payments to more than 60 service providers and retailers. So they use AWS Cloud, which allows them to process more and more retail payments data and reduce transaction times. In fact, recently, EasyPay introduced a new product, Paisa Nikal, which created new revenue streams for their retailers and allows them now to offer services such as cash withdrawals, money transfer, utility bill payments. During the pandemic, one of their retailers, Kirana Shop, which uses EasyPay services, became a medium for cash withdrawal benefits of various government schemes related to COVID. So EasyPay then supported over 150,000 transactions per day, amounting to 20 billion Indian rupees. And that is just between April and July of 2020. And EasyPay relied on AWS to cater for the surge of transactions and payments, which is now accessible in 12 states in India.
And Saray, just focusing on some of the excluded demographics, women are vastly overrepresented among those who do not have access to common financial services, such as savings accounts, loans and payments, payment systems, let alone investment services or financial advice. What are some distinct ways in which women spend and think about money, and how has technology been able to help address those needs?
I mean, this is a personal opinion, and from experience, what I observe is that a lot of the time, women are excluded because there's a lot of cultural factors behind. And to some extent, there's some legal biases that also play a role. For instance, and I share with you the case in Cambodia. We have the banking sector and we have the microfinance sector. Microfinance, obviously, as its name suggests, is microloan. And in microfinance sector, about 75% of the borrowers are women. So it's fairly easy for women to access credit at a smaller size. And it usually used towards very substantial sort of purposes. So it can be some for medical fees, a small medical fees, school fees. It can be, you know, setting up a shops in front of the house or something, right? But then if we move up to the banking sector, the number of women of borrowers in the banking sector will become much less than men. And so I discussed with the bankers and the women entrepreneurs, and I realized that when women borrow at a bigger amount, there is this sort of prejudice on, you know, women being an entrepreneur. And the questions as part of the credit analysis would be, if you run this company, are you married? Who is looking after your children? If you do, if you run the company, so that the kind of questions already is quite penalizing for women. The other thing is, if a woman were to borrow, then you would need some form of collateral. And a lot of the collaterals for women who are married, at least, would be co-owned by the husband. And so if you want to pledge the collateral to the banks, then you need the husband to also sign or be a co-borrower. And then this, again, is some of the unconscious legal biases. When you ask usually the husband to co-sign on a business run by the women, there's this, then again, also the cultural prejudice or pressure on men who allow their women to go and do businesses. So they tend to hesitate on that. And so this is important for financial institutions to look at other factors to allow women to access to financial services, particularly credit. And that's, as I mentioned earlier, is to look at the behavior of the borrowers rather than purely looking at, you know, what sort of collaterals you have to pledge. And, you know, being able to understand this person as a person, spending behavior, understanding the business cash flow, would tremendously help this woman to be more independent in terms of accessing to financial services. And you particularly mentioned about cloud, and I think again, it's, also, same answer as to my first, answer earlier, is that it greatly facilitates, and I think Agnes mentioned this as well, facilitates adoptions of new technologies. And if it's pay as you go, then it would be less costly for financial institution to implement, and they can change it. You know, if they don't have to reinvent the wheel at first. Second is that they can always test and change to other thing if the first one doesn't work, and without incurring that much cost. And in a way, it would help everyone.
Thank you, Sarah. Agne, how is technology serving some of these more vulnerable demographics in society, such as women, as Sarah just mentioned? So in particular, to gain greater access to financial products and services. And do you have any examples of these?
Yes, thank you, Bhavan. So financial institutions are increasingly migrating to cloud, and really it creates the opportunity for lower operational costs and greater ability to customize the products. Cloud technology offers that ease of integration, flexible data management, and that helps the companies to offer less expensive and more adaptable financial services for vulnerable societies. And I wanted to share a few examples here. And one, in fact, goes back to what Sarah was saying about micro-lending, specifically targeting women. So one of our customers, Amarta, in Indonesia, which is a peer-to-peer lending platform, which provides basically micro loans to entrepreneurs in rural areas of Indonesia. Their focus is focusing on extending financial services to small and micro businesses, mainly targeting working age mothers with dependents. It's a really interesting focus, but that specifically goes back to what Sarah was saying. And this service requires substantial data analytics and processing, which are basically needed to identify potential non-performing loans for its customers. So because of that, Amarta chose to move to the cloud and to be able to analyze all of that data that's required to assess the performance of the loans. Building the such analytics capabilities on premises, from Amarta's perspective, was actually too expensive. So the company decided to move to a cloud-based solution. And we understand that today, Amarta's infrastructure costs were reduced by 20% compared to what they were planning in on-premises environment. I would also like to add that impact of cloud on financial inclusion extends beyond just making financial products accessible, affordable, well, and easily available, cloud also enables innovative business models. And one of the examples would be our customer Hara in Indonesia, which basically connects rural smallholder farmers with banks and insurance companies through data by facilitating data sharing and exchange. And so far, Hara has enabled disbursement of microloans worth 13.3 billion Indonesian rupiahs by boarding 31,000 plus farmers across 741 villages in Indonesia. So this ecosystem, it basically provides access to reliable information that allows for that inclusion to happen. And they selected AWS for hosting their data exchange platform.
Thank you, Agne. Saray, when we turn to the policy side, education of the consumers, financial literacy, instilling greater financial competence, digital competency, as technology paves the way for fostering greater inclusion, what other policy support do we need to bolster both private and public digital efforts? And how are public policymakers and technology providers working together to achieve greater financial inclusion?
If it's a matter of financial inclusion, I think you rightly point out that financial literacy and digital literacy is very important, because when we praise technology of helping people access to financial services, we made a big assumption that the people know how to use technology. And reality, not everyone can use technology, particularly women. So I think it's very important to look for sustainable solution. I think education, starting very young, would be very beneficial. In Cambodia, we try to embed financial literacy into the general education program. And currently we're testing with students in grade 4 and grade 7. Trying to embed financial literacy, interest calculations, for example, in their math class and, you know, borrower's responsibility in their social subject, social science subject. That's one. In terms of digital literacy, this is something that would probably eventually need to be in the general education program. I mean, the younger you learn about it, the better. But let's talk about, you know, now, because we can't wait a new whole new generation to acquire it before introducing it, right? And so what I'm actually quite disappointed is that a lot of the development partners, they want to work on financial inclusion, but very few actually want to do anything in the financial literacy. Because literacy and digital literacy, and I think one of the main reasons is that it's very difficult to quantify your effort, right? How much somebody has learned it. It's not like you give out, you give a fund and then you can measure how many people have access to the cheap funding that you provided, right? But when you talk about building capacity, it's really difficult to quantify. And a lot of the development partners and even companies tend to shy away from those kind of area. The National Bank of Cambodia worked with Visa Foundation on financial literacy. It's been really helpful. But I really hope to see more sort of private sector join the effort into this space in particular. Anything literacy, from financial literacy to digital literacy. And I understand it's not easy to quantify and, you know, show to your shareholders what you've achieved, but it needs to be done. It's a long-term effort that needs to be done.
Thank you, Saray. Agne, Saray mentioned the private sector doing more here. You've come up with a digital skills report. Could you maybe lend some insights here as well?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Bhavan. So we definitely believe that capturing the benefits of technologies today for everyone, including the women and other communities, will require massive digital skills training. We fully agree with that, Saray. So we recently commissioned a report that analyzed the digital skills applied by workers in their jobs today and the skills that will be required by the workforces in the next 5 years. And the findings showed that digitally skilled workers today will need to enhance their skills. So it's not just the ones that are not currently in the digital sector. Non-digitally skilled workers will need to learn such digital skills to remain in the roles or access better jobs, and the students will need to learn in-demand skills to improve their employability. Advanced cloud computing and data skills will become more important for current and future workers, with these skills projected to triple, according to our study, by 2025. Cloud architecture design consistently emerged as one of the top five most in-demand skills by 2025 in all of our countries. At AWS, we're seeking to bridge those gaps with various training programs. To date, for example, we offer around 500 free on-demand online courses that are available in multiple languages, such as Bahasa Indonesia, Japanese, Korean, simplified and traditional Chinese. We provide training courses taught by AWS instructors for workers that are interested to upskill or reskill, and also organizations who want to upskill their employees. These courses cover a range of topics like cloud architecture, cybersecurity, data analytics. And Saray, you mentioned the students, the education. So the students, for example, today can gain access to free self-paced online learning content that we offer, which basically allows them to prepare for cloud career pathways. And according to our study, I mean, the jobs which would be popular then are cloud engineer, cybersecurity specialist, machine learning scientist, or data scientist jobs. So all of that content and training available would be really helping the students to prepare for these jobs.
Thank you, Agne. Saray, how do we reach that last mile we've been talking about, solving the on-the-ground problems of identity, the access still remains. The lack of centralized ID systems has been pointed to as a major prerequisite to some of the digital solutions we've seen. So how can technology help?
Yeah, before answering your question, Pavin, maybe just a request to Agnes, if you could share, you know, the links that you mentioned for the free courses. That would be good. So I can share it with with the schools that we work here and also the women entrepreneurs that we also worked with. Back to your question, Pavin, I don't think I have a solution. I'll probably have more problem to be solved. A lot of the time when we talk about financial inclusion, it's usually happened in developing country. It's not a problem of the developed world, right? Well, I mean, to some extent, yes, but they're mostly developing countries. And so when we talk about technologies, we talk about data, we make a lot of assumption behind those. And particularly in terms of infrastructure, all right, access to electricity to start with. We assume that everyone will have access to electricity. We assume that everyone will have access to smartphone. And we assume that everyone will have access to stable and affordable internet service. I think these are the very basic prerequisite that governments need to work on. And a lot of the times there's a debate as to, you know, what kind of infrastructure you need to prioritize for government, for instance. I mean, do we go and build roads and bridges, or do we go and build cable lines and all this? And there's no right answer. It depends, you know, on what is already existing. And with limited resources, I mean, we really have to scratch our head and see, you know, what is it that we need to spend on. Then when we achieve all this basic infrastructure, there's a lot more infrastructure that we need to think about. Digital ID is one because, of course, obviously, if you move into the digital space, you need to know who you are talking with behind the screen. And then we also need to think about consent and authorization. we are going to have a lot of information. I mentioned to you earlier about, you know, financial institution accessing to my payment history, to a lot of things about me, and probably my social media account as well. And as a chair of the chairwoman of the Cambodian Credit Bureau here, I have learned a lot. Not something that we haven't done it here in Cambodia, but I've heard that there are countries where, you know, companies are allowed to access people's social media account and do a psychometric on the way you use your smiley faces, the way you use punctuation in on your Facebook account, and come up with, you know, a behavioral rating about you, the way you charge your mobile phone. You know, if you're a responsible user by charging your phone, you know, at a 20% battery low, or at a zero, at you wait until it's reached zero, or you know, until you can't use it. All these are required a lot of thinking behind how, I mean, as policymakers, how much do I want, you know, people to access my information? I know I'm going to benefit from, you know, allowing them accessing my information, but do I need it, right? If I don't have the credit, I don't mind, you know, people using this information if it means that it's going to help me to access loan. But if I already have a credit, then I wouldn't want anyone to see, you know, how I use my punctuations. I'm not good with spelling anyway, so that's going to be very bad. So consent and authorization are also something that we need to think about. So not just the digital identities. The next thing is you need to be able to create, you know, a data platform, a data exchange that allow you to be able to identify that person across different platforms and enable digitization to really be efficient. And then the fourth, I think it's does that remember correct? It's payment and settlement. And these are the basic foundational stack. The Monetary Authority of Singapore has published a report recently on global foundational stack. I think you can look up. And Cambodia has also, National Bank of Cambodia has also joined in the, as a case study in the report. And it's really make an interesting case as to we want digitizations, but what are the prerequisites for it to work?
And Agnes, just turning to you, Suri mentioned a few things here, identity, there's a KYC angle here, the data flows. Any comments on that and how AWS is working with some of these data flows, cross-borders, KYC solutions as well?
Yes, so cross-border data flows are really essential for the communities to benefit from public cloud and broader technology benefits. Cloud technology can help overcome the local infrastructure constraints. Some of the developing countries, as Sarah was mentioning, right, they lack sufficient digital infrastructure and broadband capacity to support domestic data centers. And in this case, the public cloud allows computing demands and data processing requirements to be distributed across borders. So this way, then the consumers and businesses can circumvent the digital bottlenecks via the cross-border data flows and benefit from those services and data centers located in more advanced or other economies. Therefore, the supporting of cross-border data flows is extremely essential from policymakers' perspective as well. Now, going back to know your customer or digital identity requirements, I wanted to tell a little story of example of our customer that helps with that as well. So that is our customer Neera in India, which is a consumer finance startup that provides small loans to lower income groups across large metropolitan and smaller cities in India. So Neera targets the underserved market segments, individuals who struggle to obtain loans for personal and family needs. Many of them lack proper identification documents required to obtain lines of finance in larger banks. So Neera provides the pre-approved credit limits free of any fees and requests less documentation than you would be required in standard banking or financial institutions. Now, how does Nira do that? They actually uses, Nira uses Amazon Recognition, which is our machine learning product, to verify images and connect them with customers' Aadhaar cards, which are government-issued ID cards. So this way, basically, that machine learning tool allows them to use different ID system to link it to the government system to facilitate the microloans.
Just one final question for you. Trust in a new solution or system is an important element here, alongside privacy, other features like resiliency and security. So how do we take those properties that consumers desire in payments, banking and savings, and translate that to a digital means that is secure, resilient, and protects consumers' data and instills trust?
So helping to protect the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of our customers' systems and data is the utmost importance to AWS, as is maintaining customer trust and confidence. AWS provides a secure and resilient cloud infrastructure. By using AWS, financial institutions can boost their capacity to support increasing transaction volumes. They can track and manage changes in their system, all of their deployments at the same time. They have up-to-date capacity and architecture. Additionally, of course, they can maintain backups on the cloud. To AWS, the shared responsibility, which we have together with our customers, means that application security relies on both AWS and our financial services customers. So we manage the security of the cloud, protecting its infrastructure and services, upholding the operational performance, and complying with legal and regulatory requirements. Now, our customers then manage the security of their content, applications, systems, and networks in the cloud environment. From data storage to analytics to machine learning and artificial intelligence, cloud has enabled financial organizations to access a wide range of services on demand. Cloud elasticity enables organizations to scale up as well as contract resources when they need it and drop them when they no longer need them. The scalable and secure infrastructure is helping the financial sector to modernize and innovate faster, obtain more insights to make better decisions, access the customers, provide real-time information. At AWS, we are very excited with the idea that by enabling more innovation, cloud computing can support financial inclusion as well and drive economic and social change.
Thank you. And on that final point, that concludes today's podcast. Thank you for joining us today, Saray and Agne. It's been a pleasure to speak with you both. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to our channel. We are both on iTunes and Spotify. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.